It's time for class. And therefore, that was a call to prayer. This is the prayer of beauty from the Art of Living. O Lord, lead us from darkness to light. From chaos to order. From separateness to oneness, from hate to love, from fear to courage, from ignorance to wisdom, and from ugliness to beauty. Let thy heavenly design inspire us. Let our heart be filled with love for perfection. Let our mind be filled with nobility and wisdom. Let our hands express themselves with grace and harmony, and let beauty be the reward. Okay, any comments or questions about the prayer? Any questions from the first day of instruction?
Carl?
Yes.
Carl?
Yes.
You're not as loud today as you were Monday.
I'm doing it right now. Is that better?
Much better. Thank you.
All right. Again, any other comments or questions or comments on the prayer or anything at all?
Carl?
Yes.
I always love the prayer and I love the way that it seems to speak
to all of us. Good. Any further comments? Then let us move right ahead into our next session. You're all familiar with the quote at the end of John Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn. Beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know. I guess one could teach school by simply having all the children memorize that statement because that's all they need to know. Truth is beauty is truth, truth is beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know. What does this mean? How does beauty equate with truth or vice versa? What is Keats saying here? Now, this is a quote. It's the urn speaking back, the return of the urn, so to speak. Beauty is truth, truth is beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know. What does it mean? Why is beauty truth and truth beauty?
Well, because unlike the old cliche, beauty is in the mind of God. In the eye of God, I suppose. And if we understand, if we see things the way God sees things, then we understand what we need to live our lives effectively.
Okay, but I understand that. That's an excellent point, and certainly one worth ruminating on. But why is beauty the same as truth? He equates them. Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty. And the implication is that once you know that, you know everything. Worth knowing.
Yeah.
But what does that mean? I mean, I don't disagree with anything you said, Betty. Those are good observations, but they don't necessarily answer the question, how is beauty the same as truth and truth the same as beauty? Rose.
You've often said that the feminine, the naked feminine form represents truth. And that,
right.
would also be beauty.
Okay.
So how does that fit in there?
Well, I think that's another expression of it. The idea that the nude feminine form, the unclothed The naked truth.
The naked truth.
The unclothed feminine form is a esoteric symbol for beauty. And that's the whole idea behind Isis Unveiled. We tend to veil the truth with all of our ignorance here on Earth. And once we strip away the veils, then we have beauty and truth. But that's another statement of this, but I'm not sure it indicates why beauty is truth and truth is beauty. Fully.
This might be related to what Rose just said, but at the end of that story we read yesterday on Death Hill, she, to be recommended beauty, she came to Earth and she was able to look at everything and say, this is beautiful. Why, it's beautiful. Whereas Earth was saying it was ugly. There was nothing good about it.
Okay, I think you're moving towards the point. However,
beyond the visible, she sensed potential or the reality of Earth.
Okay, you're getting there. Other input.
Something about what you said that made me think of penetration, like penetrating to the heart of, whatever it is, whether it's a thought or emotion or a physical thing or the divine archetypes. Just thinking like, that would be a way to equate beauty with truth.
Well, you're getting there. Everybody is getting there.
You have something. They seem to be reflecting.
Rose.
They seem to be reflecting one another.
Are they reflecting one another? Well, that's an interesting thought. Let's put that in the equation and see how much they reflect one another. Who had something?
Wait. Thinking that there's something about beauty as a conduit, as purity, as directing us, to see something. There's something about it being a conduit and holding something.
Okay. All right. Again, you're getting there. Put those pieces together, and you'll be much closer.
Carl.
Yes.
I'm thinking in terms of a goal of accomplishment, and to get there, the truth may seem uncomfortable or hard to swallow, but in the long run, it really is beauty because you're reaching those goals, you're reaching those accomplishments in growing and learning and what we're trying to do in this life.
Okay, now that's an interesting addition to the discussion because it's very difficult to find the equation of truth and beauty in physical activities or even achievements. Except in the sense of fulfillment, the accomplishment that you mentioned. And of course you can't, but we have to link our understanding of truth and beauty with accomplishment and achievement. So we've got another piece of the puzzle here. But we're kind of dancing around the edges here and not really, even with Donna's penetration here, we're not quite tapping it. Other input. Well, let me ask some questions and we'll talk some more and maybe by the end we'll figure this out. What does it mean to be truthful? To be full of it. I mean, full of truth. Anybody?
On some level, it means sort of not having illusions, you know, sort of clearing yourself of illusions about yourself first, so that you can look at things and understand the, again, penetrating to sort of the heart of a situation or maybe a person.
Ah, okay, now we're getting to the essence. Okay, we're making some progress here. We have to, of course, the word essence is an interesting one because those of you who know any Latin recognize that essence is esse, which means being. Essence is the beingness, the inner being of any reality. So when I teach the basic course and I introduce you to the inner self, the inner being, we're talking about essence. And both truth and beauty lie at the level of essence or archetypal pattern. So being truthful literally is being true to the essence. And that brings in that concept of the conduit, the connection between the essence and the expression, and the sense of accomplishment and achievement, because one cannot fulfill anything short of fulfilling the divine plan. And so being truthful means being true to the essence. All right. What does it mean to see the truth?
Well, you see the essence.
All right, how do you see the essence?
Being one with it.
All right, what does it mean to be one with the essence? Well, you can clear away all the illusions and still not be at one with the essence. I mean, detachment is one step, attunement's the second step. And it's important to have that pattern in mind, that clearing away the illusions is detachment. Attunement is the act of attunement to truth or beauty or whatever it is.
Well, you've always said the essence of a flower is beauty. It's whether it's color.
Okay.
The flower is truth because it's being itself.
Well, the truth is that it's true to its design.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so what
is that our goal? Our design?
Why is a flower beautiful? Is this just something that all humanity agrees upon? Or we've been brainwashed into believing? Or is there something greater than that that makes it beautiful?
God's perfection or the light that God has infused in it.
Alright. Why is a flower beautiful and other forms of life aren't?
Well, maybe other forms of life are and we don't see it, or maybe because we have distorted the light that God put into it.
Well, maybe. Are there other possibilities?
Is it expressing its purpose?
Well,
the beauty of a flower, I mean, I've never met a person yet
Weeds. Right. Absolutely. Amen to that. Well, here, this is, you pretty much gotten to the truth.
We're all around it.
Yeah. The, what I'm driving at here is that the rose or the petunia or whatever it is beautiful because, as DK points it, the flower kingdom has pretty much reached its ultimate evolutionary goal. It is fulfilling its divine design. Whereas in humanity, only a few people have fulfilled their divine design. Most people are struggling and they live lives of lesser beauty, imperfect beauty. But beauty is, that which fulfills the design. If you go back and reread our essay on beauty, it's filling life with beauty. Filling, fulfilling. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies. This is what, I mean, we use that song in the essay to demonstrate that beauty leads to beautifulness. Full of beauty, full of the divine design, radiating the its essence. Flowers do that. Generally speaking, most minerals don't, and most animals don't, and that includes humanity, but we're on our way. And we've had some remarkable examples of human beings that do. Do that. So getting back to the question, what does it mean to see the truth? This should be easy now. Well, basically it means that when you look at flowers, you see the truth. You in their case, it's the appearance is the truth. If you link it, if you allow that to link yourself to the incredible power and design of the flower, when you're overwhelmed, when you go out and you see a sea of daffodils, as Wordsworth did, and you're overwhelmed by the beauty of it all, you're in communion, or at least he was, and everybody who reads the poem correctly, you're in communion with the beauty of that design. Yes, Rose.
But so then the scene is really, it seems to me, that's the intuitive connection.
Of course. The intuitive connection. When you look at, when I'm teaching and I clairvoyantly see how you're working with the energy of the meditation, I'm seeing the beauty within you, struggling to paddle its way to the surface and break out and say, I'm here. And this is the point of looking for the light within other people. How much do they manifest it? How much do they rely upon it? Can you rely upon it? What is the, so in other words, it would be what is, in most people, the beauty and the truth of their life is entirely in potential. It's a possibility. You have to go to the level of the soul, and then, of course, it's perfectly evident. But most people do a wonderful job of disguising it and hiding behind less than beautiful appearances. All right, in your mental exploration, what is the highest level of truth you have discovered?
I think one of the things that I discovered is that I've never looked. I'm not isolated, I'm not, which is an illusion, you know, that
Loneliness is the illusion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And oneness is
the truth. Right. Okay.
Unity is the truth.
Okay.
At whatever level I can understand unity,
okay, I think you just hit the nail fairly squarely on the head. Truth lies in wholeness and unity, not in separation and individuality. Individuality is important, and we're meant to bring individuality to its full flower, but that is as a connection to wholeness. Yes. Oh, okay. Who else? Okay. Who else? The question is, what's the highest level of truth you've discovered?
I discovered that all...
Are you with us? Ready? We seem to have lost you, Betty.
I'm sorry. I discovered that all the elements of my life that I thought were difficult or inappropriate or were so frustrating to me, in hindsight, as I reflect back upon them, they perfectly fit into a pattern that helped me to grow in understanding and to get to the lessons that I was supposed to learn and integrate into my life.
Uh-huh.
The time that I was going through them, you know, it was like, take this cup away from me.
Right. So you learned that in spite of the appearance of chaos, life is ordered and good.
Correct.
Okay. I think that's important. I'll get... give you all a chance to continue talking in a moment. But this last month or so, somebody emailed me. I don't know this person from anybody, but somebody emailed me and wanted to start a dialogue, but this is a person that expressed doubt of the inner dimensions of beauty and truth and all other things. Was claimed to have an open mind about it, but expressed doubt that such a thing existed. And I wrote back and said, doubt is a very pernicious thing. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you doubt what you're going to find, you won't find it. And until you overcome this doubt, I basically challenged them to get the doubt out. But I said, you're limiting yourself tremendously until you overcome this doubt. And ultimately, this is the hardest leap anybody makes in order to develop intuition, is you can develop minor psychic skills, astrally and mentally, but until you overcome doubt and have no doubt about the origin of life and the origin of ideas and so on, then one is constantly, the truth is constantly elusive. It's like you reach out for it and it slithers away. So I've had this personal demonstration, not that I had any doubt, but I've tried to coach this person to overcome this life-crushing doubt. And about the origin of ideas and so on. And it basically just boils down to this: he hasn't experienced it, so it doesn't exist. This is the attitude that we're facing in humanity today. There are a lot of people who, because of quote-unquote universal education, have the appearances of intelligence without any accompanying wisdom. And when you scratch the surface of their song and dance, you find that there's just this enormous structure of doubt that keeps them from making that leap. And so their lives are anything but truthful. They can't have any fulfillment because doubt stands in their way. So the discovery of oneness and the discovery that there is order and pattern in the universe, these are things that we might take for granted because they happen so subtly and quietly, but it's useful to look at them and realize that you've discovered a level of truth that most people haven't. So, go on. I'd like to hear other people answer this question. What's the highest level of truth you've discovered?
Well, I agree with getting in touch with I'm not alone and planned guidance and life is ordered and good. I would add to it that for myself, although I know to be intentional and serious in pursuing truth, there what I've discovered as well is humor and lightheartedness.
You've discovered joy. The soul, the constant mood of the soul is joyfulness. When you are in any kind of connection, contact with the soul, it's almost impossible to be downhearted. You can get run over by mass consciousness, of course. But the moment you allow the soul to exalt you again and you practice detachment, you return to the core of joy. And so, yes, the sign of a wise person is always their humor, their joy. But that isn't to turn it around and say anybody who is humorous is wise. Because there are a lot of people who are humorous in a mean, life-antagonistic way. And they don't understand the falseness of their humor. Good point. Who else?
I was thinking that
Humor
is the younger, I used to always say what I love most about life is there's always more to learn. And I think that classes, I just learned that even more, that growth never ends. And that's the thing that just becomes more and more beautiful, it's ever expanding. And, we're always developing. There's more that we can learn. That's what I love about the soul's journey.
I'm
just not excited
for,
what you
die. So you can do it even before you die.
Well, no, it's now, man, it just never ends. And I think that's part of it, just more and more.
Okay, these are all good answers. Anybody else? Yeah. Speak up a tiny bit, please. Good. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that because that brings in that concept of wholeness and oneness again. It's the one source, and every time you go back to that source, you find new enrichment, new nourishment. And in fact, unless you trace an idea all the way back to that common source, there is no nutrition in the idea that you discovered. There's no real nourishment in the ideas of somebody else, or partial truths, or to use an example here, in an ideology or a theology, there is no real nourishment. You have to trace it all the way back to the source to tap that nourishment. Okay, the tautology is presented, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That's all you know on earth and all you need to know. All you know on earth and all you need to know. Why does he state this tautology? That this is all you need to know.
It encompasses everything.
Exactly. The key word is all. It's all you know on earth and all you need to know. You need to know all. It's just a literal statement. When you're on earth, you need to know that earth is part of a great allness. All, everybody together, all, no. Or as I put it in Plato's cave, the wall is all. We need to have that's of course somewhat satiric, but we need this sense of allness, and it's in allness that both beauty and truth reside. So is there truth in physical beauty? I'm sorry?
Well, to the degree that it would be expressing its divine design.
Okay, Rose says to the degree that it's expressing its divine design. Do the definitions we have of physical beauty, are they required for that expression of the divine design?
Obviously not.
Okay, Rose says obviously not. Well, so there is truth in physical beauty, but not in the physical aspect of physical beauty. The truth is a reference point. The beauty is the suggestion, because somebody who is old and wrinkled probably wouldn't fit our modern definition of beauty, and yet might be exuding great beauty through their acts and love and kindness. So is there truth in emotional beauty? What is emotional beauty, and is there truth in it? Okay, now keep in mind, joy is not an emotion. Happiness might be, but joy is not an emotion. You can express cheerfulness, and that's and lightheartedness, those might be emotional, but not necessarily.
But those emotions can be used as
part of the service. Sure. Absolutely. But it's all by expression of the higher. And so it's the way in which, go ahead. Rose.
Only as the emotions would be enriching the experience or whatever.
Okay. If the emotions.
Would be the enrichment would have to be
right
there.
Let me rephrase this then. Is there truth in anger? Is there truth in hatred? Is there truth in jealousy? Is there truth in grief?
Those are all destructive.
They're all destructive. They all destroy truth. Is there truth in doubt? In doubt. See, this is the huge problem for science today. They think that doubt is the handmaiden of truth. They doubt psychic abilities. They doubt, cast aspersions, or make fun of astrology. They doubt, you know, if you took any science and traced it back to its roots, you would find something that modern science discards. If you take chemistry and trace it back to its roots, you find alchemy. And modern science poo-poos it. If you take mathematics and trace it back to its roots, you find Pythagoras. And while they embrace the Pythagorean theorem because they can't do anything else, they reject everything else Pythagoras said and taught. And the same thing with Plato. You can't help embracing Plato because he's a giant of Western philosophy, but when it comes to Plato talking about Atlantis and describing Atlantis, oh, that's just a little fiction he invented. See? Doubt. So we have to fully understand that the moment doubt creeps in and rears its ugly little face, truth is out the window. Doubt cuts off and obliterates or obviates truth and wisdom. So, yes, in order for the way you were answering those earlier questions about is there truth in physical beauty and truth in emotional beauty, you were answering my next question, how can one express truth at these levels? How can one be truthful mentally and emotionally and physically? And the answer is what you were saying. You can avoid expressing the negative emotions, which can or thoughts, which cancel things out, and you can tie all your thoughts back to their origin. To sum up, because we're running out of time here, truth lies in wholeness. It embraces all facts, all knowledge. It is therefore the quintessence of beauty and fulfillment. Any final comments or observations about this?
Well, just as you were talking about being truthful mentally, emotionally, and physically, it reminded me of the prayer of health.
Sure. That's good. Lots of things should remind you of that prayer. Anything else? Okay. Let's see. Time for the next session. And nobody has commented on the fact that you can't see my computer screen. Now you should be able to. There wasn't anything to see anyway, but here's our wonderful Walnut Grove logo. Okay, we're moving right along here. The second session every day, we're talking about the five stages of reading and meaning. Before I go ahead with this, any questions from yesterday's discussion of word recognition, letter recognition? And of course, when people think literally, they are letting the literal meaning of words destroy their thinking, because all they're doing is word recognition. In this day and age, literal meaning, literal interpretation of words doesn't even trace it back to the origins, the original meaning. A literal meaning is what it means in today's vernacular, nothing more. Which it means it's completely disconnected from the truth. So, if you hear the word for, which we talked about 2 days ago, how do you know how to interpret the meaning? If I just say for, it could be for a warning in golf, duck. It could be the number for, a quantity, 1, 2, 3, 4. It could be a nautical term, meaning the part of the boat that lies in front of you. It could be used in the phrase, coming to the fore, meaning that it came to your attention. To the ear, all those different meanings have one common pronunciation, for. They have different spellings, yes. But to the ear, audibly, how do you know what it means? Just word recognition alone still leaves you in a quandary, especially in English, where some words have a dozen meanings, maybe more. So we discern meaning from experience, our own experience, and using these words coupled with context. If you are out on the golf course, you still have to discern whether your golfing partner is telling you that they just shot a four on the last hole, or whether some idiot has hit a ball that's coming your way. And usually the context is clear. The great problem of reading is not letter or word recognition, it's the ability to accurately discern the meaning and intent of the author. Now, English scholars have done mental somersaults and cartwheels and whatnot, trying to say that the work stands on its own and doesn't matter what the author meant. That's the what they call the intentional fallacy. If you try to figure out this is what the author meant, then you're limiting your ability to enjoy the work of art. And in fact, you're cutting out 9/10 of their livelihood because they consider their interpretation of a work of art far greater than the author's original meaning or your understanding of it. So they're there to tell you what this piece of art represents or writing. So we have to be able to discern the intent and meaning of the author or communication breaks down. And maybe your interpretation is better than what the author meant. Or maybe we have to consider the possibility that not all writing is done by the author himself or herself. That there are spooks involved that are spook writing, ghost writing, and the intent is from the inner dimensions, and the author simply carries it through without recognizing and interpreting the meaning. So let's start with a practical example that you all know. How is it possible that some people read the words, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," and construe those words to mean that the Constitution mandates separation of church and state? How is that possible? Is there any suggestion of a separation of church and state in the words, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof"?
That's just what they want it to mean.
It's exactly. Rose is right. It's what they want it to mean. Did anybody else have a comment on that?
Just that they already have, you know, an agenda or whatever. They have something that they want to espouse, and they'll use anything to support it, even the Constitution, you know, by distorting the Constitution or something like that.
Okay. So that.
So it's not the words that come first, but the meaning that comes, or the understanding that comes from the words. The meaning of the words is interpreted through whatever.
Right. And that happens in everything they do. They read the newspaper or watch the news. They're interpreting it in terms of their preconceived coloration. They read a book on chemistry and they read it from their point of view. And that means that they're not reading the words at all. They're reading a reflection of their own thought or emotion. And it means that somewhere along the line, they fail to learn what it means to read and comprehend. They don't know how to glean the meaning of what they read. As shocking as this may be to you, there are some people whose minds have actually been trained to work by association rather than logical reasoning. I'm not referring to the associative mechanism here. The associative mechanism is good and should be cultivated. I'm talking about They have no sense of innate priority in reading. And so they listen to this and they say, Congress shall make no law. Well, that should apply equally to the obverse as to the positive statement. They should not make no law protecting religion either. Because they just gloss over the prohibition of the free exercise thereof. They read a statement like that, they pick out one or two words that, as Donna pointed out, support their agenda, and then they come up with a completely false interpretation of the words. Not false from a political point of view, false from a literal point of view. So part of learning to read for comprehension is learning to establish priority of importance in the sentences and paragraphs you read. If you pick out a single word, religion, and respond emotionally to it because you're an atheist, then then equate it with the clause Congress shall make no law, you're heading for disaster. These people interpret the no in the sentence of no law to negate any relationship between Congress and religion. In their minds, this means that you can't even have a prayer in Congress or in school or when you're riding your bike because it's out in the public. And hence, to them, the idea of separation of church and state makes perfect sense to them, not to us. And of course, the passage says no such thing, but in their minds, it does. I was mentioning that I've exchanged emails with a fellow that says he doubts the essence of archetypal thoughts. I've explained to him the destructive nature of doubt and how he has poisoned his mind with it. He's well-read, but doesn't understand what he has read. Without experience, it proves that there are no archetypes, which can't be done. He is willing to believe that they may not exist, even though he rejects my first-hand testimony on the thin grounds that it may just be my belief, not my daily experience. And the fact that I can point to thousands of other people who have had similar experiences means nothing to him for the very same reason. Hasn't been his daily experience. He's not willing to take anyone's word unless he has the experience, which he is prohibiting by maintaining doubt. So there's a never-ending loop that defies all logic and subjects him to a prison of doubt. So it's important to teach children learning to read that there's a meaning to what they read. And they have not finished reading until they comprehend that meaning in its fullest aspect. And this is absolutely indispensable, and it means establishing priority in thought processes in the sentence of learning to see traps. There are a whole bunch of traps in meaning. As you read, you may come across an ironic statement, and you have to have the ability to understand that the author is being ironic and saying exactly the opposite of what the meaning is. That's we don't encounter that in first and second grade usually. You know, look, Spot, there's Jane. There's no irony there, you see. But if you were to say, look, Jane, you have a spot on you, it may have a different meaning.
Does she have on a blue dress?
Yeah, she has on a blue dress. The literal meaning would be that Spot just attacked her. But we can also imagine many, many other possible meanings. Some authors use contradiction. And if we don't, they posit contradictory statements, and through working with the contradiction, you come to a closer examination of the truth. One of the things that apparently Alice Bailey's students complained about in the Blue Books was that from time to time, they thought D.K. contradicted himself on certain things. And he would always then say, oh, you think I've contradicted myself from here to there, blah, blah, blah. Let me assure you, every one of those is a true statement. There is no contradiction. You need to ponder on that. That's part of the charm of D.K. and part of the challenge of learning to read D.K. is, and it's also the moment we're schooled in current events, reading about politics and whatnot, that politicians flip-flop all over the place. Some of it is a deceitful kind of changing of the mind. Some of it's just natural evolution of thought. Of course, your opponent always accuses natural evolution of thought to be flip-flopping. And there are small-minded people who hold it against somebody that they would otherwise approve of. But then there is also the demagogic flip-flopping where you change your mind just because the political tides have changed. So we have to be on alert for that. We have to understand that there can be double entendres, triple entendres, and they enrich the style of writing tremendously, but they can play havoc with meaning. I can remember from my study of satire that John Dryden, who was considered in his day and the 100 years after to be the absolute monument of English literature, the equal of Shakespeare and Milton, for sure, maybe greater, he wrote a piece of satire that seemed to take the He belonged to a certain group of people that had certain thoughts on the subject, and he wrote a piece of irony that attacked his opponent's point of view by setting it forth as truth. It was irony. He was exaggerating everything to the point where he thought he was demonstrating the ridiculousness of the opposition. He got into a whale of trouble with his own supporters because they couldn't appreciate the irony. They thought he had defected and gone to the opposition and was now embracing that point of view. And it took a lot of splaining among people that he thought were intelligent enough to see what he was doing to restore his reputation. And we see this all the time. People make comments. People can be destroyed politically because they make some careless comment and it's taken out of context and condemned. Well, all those are things that are traps. Even illusions can be traps. You can make a simple allusion to something Ovid wrote 2,000 years ago. And in this day and age, because nobody reads Ovid or knows the quote, Your meaning may be lost entirely, and you may be condemned for it. And of course, then there's the problem that some writers and speakers use deliberate falsehoods and misstate the facts. One of my favorite stories in that regard, perhaps you've heard me say this before, but one of my favorite stories is that H.L. Mencken, writing in the early 20s or something, wrote a piece on the history of the bathtub. Total fiction. He made it all up. He said that the first bathtub was installed in the White House by Millard Fillmore. That should have been a clue. We only refer to Millard Fillmore in jest in our political society. But he had all these facts, none of which were true, but he published it. He was the editor of the paper. He could do this. And then, a half year later, he wrote a follow-up saying that it was all a hoax, and yet other papers picked it up and quoted it, and it was now in encyclopedias as fact. Nobody ran fact checks on this piece. They just reported it because they read it in the newspaper. And in spite of the fact that he announced this and retracted it and gave it equal prominence to the original piece, nobody took the entries in the encyclopedias and the quotes out of the context they had been put into them. So you can still find evidence today that the first bathtub was installed in the White House, was installed by Mildred Fillmore, even though it's complete fiction. So we have to, he of course was doing this just to show us how gullible we are when we come to reading. If we read it in the paper, we believe it's true, even though it's patently false, because we don't have the good habit of tracing things back to their source. When our local theater group was presenting Midsummer Night's Dream a few years ago, the director taught us that the key to performing Shakespeare so that the audience could understand it was very simple. In each line, you figure out what the most important word is in terms of the action. And you stress that on the basis that if the audience hears that word, it can make sense of all the rest of the words in that line. And it works because the performer is interpreting the words and giving it stress so the audience doesn't have to figure that out for themselves. And that lets you zoom right in on the meaning. And I would adopt that. This is an auditory cue as to what to focus on. And the same is an excellent rule of thumb in teaching reading skills. I don't mean word recognition now. I mean meaning recognition. What is the most important word in the line? The one that holds the clue to the line's ultimate meaning. In by line, I mean sentence. In this way, or phrase, or whatever. And in this way, you establish priority among the words you're reading. You train your mind to unlock the meaning of this special assortment of words. Now, that's a very practical, easy step that I don't think is ever taught in school. We parse sentences. We decide, this is a verb, this is a noun, this is the subject, this is the object. These are adjectives, these are adverbs, et cetera, et cetera. We parse all these things and diagram them and complex roadmaps on the chalkboard. But we don't ask the simple question, what's the most important word in this sentence? And why? And what does that link you to? Meaning. Now, a second important element in teaching children to discern meaning is to train the student to ask questions. What does this sentence mean to me? What did it likely mean to the author based on the context of the writing? What's the discrepancy between what it means to me and what the author probably meant? How big is the gap? How are you coloring what you're reading? I think that should be a whole segment in teaching reading comprehension, probably repeated over and over again through first, second, third, fourth grade, and beyond. Obviously, again, you can't do this with C-spot run, but you can do it as you get into more sophisticated levels of writing and writings with a context. Ask the student, how am I coloring my interpretation of this reading? And also ask, did the author actually know what he was writing about? Did Karl Marx actually know what he was writing about? Has anybody ever asked that question? There are people, of course, on the right who says Karl Marx didn't know what he was writing about. But they haven't actually posed the question that I've seen. Did Karl Marx actually know what he was writing about, or did he have his head wedged somewhere? And when you actually break this down, as we are seeing with the David Mamet story or book, Marx didn't know a whole lot. Marx had a lot of false assumptions. Marx had inoperative theories, theories that have been proved inoperable. So that's the second stage. The first stage is the priority. The second is, how much of a gap is there between my interpretation and what the writer was writing? So, returning to the First Amendment, how do people get a sense of a right to protest out of the words, the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of their grievances? That's the end of that First Amendment. That Congress shall pass no law that abridges the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of their grievances. How, please tell me how anybody interprets that to be a establishment of a right to protest.
It depends upon your definition of petition.
A petition?
Yeah.
Do you know? All right, how do you define petition?
Getting a bunch of signatures on legal documents.
Is that the actual meaning of petition? The important thing is what petition meant in 1789, not what it means in 2011. Because the document was written in 1789. Well, I mean, that has inevitably occurred, but that doesn't give us a clue as to what the Founding Fathers meant. Rose.
This probably isn't helpful, but when I think of that, it's, I think of, Joan Grant, Winged Pharaoh, when people would go one by one to the Pharaoh and state their case.
Right, and he had his lion sitting
and
there.
And he had his lion sitting there. But it was more, to me, it was more one person going and petitioning or, you know, with his neighbor then petitioning or saying his side of the issue. But, you know, this thing has turned into just mobs disrupting whole cities and that sort of thing. I don't know how it went from...
It's turned into moms, but it's also turned into lobbyists. I could equally ask the question, how does this passage actually justify the presence of lobbyists in Washington, throwing money around, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But Betty has the right idea here. And that is, what is the meaning of petition? I think if you look it up, I don't know, I haven't looked it up, but if you look it up, it probably means to pray. In the sense of, I pray for relief. The presentation of a formal prayer or pleading to the government. So, again, anybody else want to comment on this? How we go from the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition the government for a redress of their grievances, how do we go from that to protest, mob protest? Well,
we're talking about reading. How many people really read? And protests, before you connecting back to our last discussion on emotion, it's more of an emotional reaction to
anything. Right.
It's
an actual
process.
Right. Okay.
So people are being taught school and by seeing what people are doing. Or understanding what's happening with lobbyists or protesting in various ways and never going back to the source to actually read or think about it themselves.
Right.
And then complicating that with, if they do go back to read, they are not discerning the meaning of petition, not understanding really the meaning of what they're reading.
Right. The word protest doesn't even appear in this passage. And so protest is a modern it's been glommed on to this passage as justifying this, the right, I have a right to protest. Where is that right guaranteed in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights? It's not. The right is to peaceably assemble, like in a church social, or to petition the government. And of course, that's perfectly acceptable, to go out to the mall and have people sign your petition. But there's nowhere in the Constitution that we have a right to protest. So we have to go back and ask, as Betty suggested, but not the word petition, the word protest. What did the word protest mean in 1789, even though it wasn't included? Well, the fact is it didn't have, a protest was a statement in favor of something, not against it. I protest my innocence, sir, judge, your honor. I protest. See, it was always a positive thing. It's pro. It's not anti. If this word means anything, if we're going to describe what modern protest is, it should be anti-test. I testify against the mistreatment of animals.
To state positively, yeah. Affirm.
Protest means to
solemnly.
State positively and to affirm.
Solemnly.
On my honor.
That's sure.
Right. Actually, I looked this up, the idea of opposition to policy, that concept of protest, first appears in the mass media in 1953 as part of the civil rights movement. It was the civil rights movement that developed protest songs, protest marches, protest everything. And there was no right to protest before that. They simply decided that there should be a right to protest and tenuously hung it on these words. It's never been taken to court and adjudicated. It's not even debated in public. I'm probably the first person to talk about it in your life. So in its original form, a protest is a statement of innocence. I am innocent of all charges. That's a protest. It's a declaration of what is true, not an attack on what is false. And yet, if you were reading the word protest in a newspaper, an essay, or any place else, how would you interpret it? Well, you would only interpret it correctly and get the meaning if A, the author was using it correctly, and B, you went to the You took the time to check out the meaning of the word. We have, the point I'm getting at here is, we have been taught a false vocabulary. We have been taught modern meanings of words that go back thousands of years, and we've been taught what it's meant in the last 25, 30 years, 50 years. The word protest had no negative connotation until 50 years ago. And now we've enshrined it as a right, which of course it isn't. That's how poor our reading comprehension is, not to mention our auditory comprehension. But in order to teach writing and teach reading comprehension, we have to establish an ability to prioritize words and what we hear. We have to establish the ability to ask questions, to pursue those questions to logical ends, and then we have to question, not doubt, but question the origin of the vocabulary we use. And those are the steps in teaching reading comprehension. It's hollow and meaningless. I mean, for 50 years we've been talking about reading comprehension in school, and yet we've been teaching reading miscomprehension. We've been teaching children deliberately to misconstrue what they're reading. through sloppy habit. Comments and questions?
Carl?
Yes.
I decided to just kind of have a peek at the online dictionary, dictionary.com, to see what the meaning of protest is, because it also has a little short etymology as well. And let's face it, young people don't look at books anymore.
Probably not.
Everything comes from the internet.
Yeah.
So in the section of the thesaurus section,
right,
for the word protest, the meaning of the verb is given as complain, disapprove, argue against. And underneath that are the synonyms for the verb form of protest. And those include affirm, assert, attest, avow, as well as object and oppose,
right,
resist and revolt. So how is it that trust
but verify.
So when you're
dealing with the internet, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just, you really have to look at least in part at the original meaning.
Absolutely.
What its derivation was.
Absolutely. This is one of my most didactic things that I teach. Go back to the origin. Start at the origin. It's a mental habit. This is a study habit that people need to learn. And we haven't been taught this study habit for probably 100 years, because one of Plato's great pieces of advice is, once again from the beginning. Let's go back and start all over again, summarize what we've learned, go back to the beginning, reaffirm the beginning, and make sure that everything that we've thought since the beginning is logical. And of course, if you read Parmenides, going back to the beginning means going back to divine sources. And logic must be based on the emanations of the Logos. And we don't need to teach that in Walden Grove, at least not at this level. I think in high school it can be taught as what Plato taught. But lest any of you taking this course think that Walden Grove will be a course in esoterica, it's based, all the curriculum is based on esoteric truths, but will be presented in ways that don't require an esoteric background. I sometimes slip into the esoteric background in teaching this class because all of you have taken my classes. However, I guarantee you, if some other people who hadn't taken my classes were sitting at their computers taking it today, my approach would be substantially different. The content would be the same. But I would restrict my use of references to DK and Alice, and I can teach all this stuff without the esoteric trimmings. I do it with the esoteric trimmings because it's a form of communicating to you people, and you happen to be my students right now. But none of that would, it would be there, but it wouldn't be obvious in any Walden Grove's class. At least until students began to develop that structure themselves on their own. Any other comments here?
Carl, I have a paper version of a dictionary here at my desk, and it's 1984.
God, it's a relic.
It's just really it's really showing how the meaning of words in last so many years have been incorporated into sort of official dictionaries and so on. The first definition of protest is to object strongly, especially formally or publicly. And then the second definition is to declare earnestly and affirm.
Right. Well, you see, isn't this a wonderful exercise to focus on? because it demonstrates the point I've been making all along for years and years, that the easiest way to assault the integrity of thinking process is to change the meaning of words from one meaning to the opposite pole. This is, talk about flip-flop. Protest now means to be against instead of in favor of. The word itself says, I'm in favor of this. But we know so little Latin, and we know so little of thinking skills, that we go forward and talk about protest as though it's anti-test. And, protest, pro plus test. I testify in favor of this statement. It's clear to anybody who understands the Latin roots. But we've been snookered so much by the educational powers to be, and I'm not making any anti-educational statement here, but it's the truth. We've been so snookered by the vocabularius or vocabularians, I guess that would be the vocabularians, the villains of this story. The dreaded vocabularians have come and set up and have infiltrated humanity, and they are teaching our children sloppy thinking habits. And you cannot read sloppily and think clearly. If you read sloppily, you will think sloppily. Good thinking habits, good study habits start with careful, precise reading, where you read what is there, not what you want to be there. Okay. That's the end of this period. And we will take a 10-minute break. It is, so let's be back at 10:30.